The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but there is not a shred of evidence that God exists. Nothing. Nip, zip, zada, nada. Well, I don't agree with you, obviously. That's why I'm on the radio each week. But my special guest today does agree with you. That's why he's on the radio. As for my co-host, we have a team of expert researchers trying to figure out why she's on the radio. Actually, she's on the radio because she's a great delight to have here with me every week. Say hello to Sharon Cashard.
Thank you, Bob. Well, Dr. Price is going to be discussing today the story of Jesus and how it is similar to other common mythologies of Jesus' time. And let me give you a little bio on Dr. Price.
And now, some of you will remember, if you heard our show last week, Dr. Price was on our KPRZ show last week, our KCBQ show last week, and was going to be on our KPRZ show, but instead he's going to be for the second half this week on KCBQ. So last week we talked a lot about the existence of some kind of God, and this week we're going to funnel it down and hear his claim that maybe Jesus Christ himself never existed. Not that he wasn't the Son of God, but that he never existed.
Okay, let me give you his bio. Dr. Price earned a master's in theological studies from Conwell Seminary in the late 70s, and then he parted with traditional Christian theology and held beliefs similar to liberal Paul Tillich. Dr. Price then earned a Ph.D. in systematic theology from Drew University, and Price's liberal stance was further eroded by writings of Caput and Derrida, I think is how you say those names. Currently, he is a professor of biblical criticism at Inquiry Institute, and he's an author of numerous books, which can be seen on his website at robertmprice.mindbender.com.
Dr. Price, welcome back to our program.
Oh, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful. I had a blast talking with you last week. Now, I know we just barely scratched the surface last week because you came on mostly to talk about Jesus, and I wanted to back it up, go upstream a little bit, and talk a little bit about God. Obviously, it's hard to talk about Jesus without talking about God. However, what I'd like to do today, obviously this has to mostly be a dialogue. I'd like to give you a chance to just talk uninterrupted, so this will be a test for me if I can keep my big mouth shut till the end of the segment. That'll be the greatest miracle, Dr. Price, since the parting of the Red Sea, and you will be a believer up to the first break. After that, obviously, we have to keep it a dialogue, and I know that you're not intending to interrupt me. I know I'm not intending to interrupt you, but we will have to continue that way afterwards, but I am going to let you talk unedited, starting now. Give us your case of why you don't believe that Jesus even existed.
Well, I began to be interested in this back in 1972, I was in InterVarsity and began reading John Warwick Montgomery, Josh McDowell, F.F. Bruce, and various conservative apologists, and I ate it right up. I thought it was fascinating that one could be certain practically that Jesus had existed and did and said what the Gospels recorded. And of course, I was an avid evangelical, witnessing, praying, and so forth at the time. It all fit into that package. But as the years went by, I found that as I was going to Gordon Conwell, an evangelical seminary, though they taught no such thing. My own reading began to lead me to question more and more of this traditional package. I began to think that the arguments for the Gospels being early and accurate and for the resurrection being the only viable alternative to explain Easter just did not work. And this tormented me because I began to evaluate these arguments as one who used them in my own witnessing. But I thought, I cannot, in good conscience, try to convince others with arguments unless I find myself convinced. If I try to put myself in the place of someone who is not an avid believer, the more I did that, the more I found that these arguments did not seem to me to hold water, and largely because there was a vast amount of information about other ancient figures rather like Jesus, including dying and rising gods of Mediterranean antiquity, Osiris, Attis, Tammuz, Dionysus, etc., whose myths and ritual cults in sacraments even sounded so much like this and could even be shown to predate the New Testament, that I began to think, well, this certainly does not prove Christianity is not true, but it certainly makes it a lot more of a toss-up. And then there were even medieval messiahs who had the same sort of careers and catastrophes and recoveries from them and so on. And I thought, even the death of the Messiah wouldn't be enough to require a miracle to keep the religion going. And one thing after another, one domino fell, and that's when I began to re-examine liberal theology and the like. And through all of this, I did not want to become an enemy of Christianity, and don't think I have now. I consider myself kind of a disappointed apologist, and yet I do not regret that, because the questions and the observations I made have opened up the Bible to me in whole new ways that are more exciting than ever. I do not have any conventional religious beliefs, but then again, I was always told one need not settle all the questions before one could go ahead and experience God. So I go to church, I take communion, I sing the hymns and pray the prayers, and with sincerity, I simply realize that philosophical questions about the existence of God are not answered that way, nor are historical questions. And as far as I can see with the history, the Gospels really do not appear to me to be historical material, and there is so little evidence within or without the New Testament about a historical Jesus that it's an open question whether there ever was one. I do not think or teach or believe that there wasn't. I don't think we can know. I do not think it would be preferable to say there was no historical Jesus. It just seems to me that it is genuinely an open question.
Okay, well, I noticed a pause there, and we still haven't gotten to our break. I want to make do my promise. Do you have a little more to add, or do you want me to start dialoguing with you?
Well,
right now?
I just like to try to give people a sense of where I'm at, that I'm not trying to attack anything. I'm not your typical opponent of religion and conservatism. It might be of interest to know I'm a Republican. I gladly voted for George Bush and would again if I had the chance. I'm not some sort of railing ACLU type person.
That's good to hear.
And everybody, he left out the most important part. I got Dr. Price to confess over the air that he's a Star Trek fan.
Yes.
So this makes him a very likable guy. You know, saying the gospel aren't accurate, that's one thing. If he had dared to touch Star Trek, we'd have had some serious contention here. Well, Dr. Price, let me ask you a question. If the same amount of historical evidence that speaks of a miraculous Jesus instead spoke of a Jesus as a mere man who, say, gave a speech or started a revolution, would you have any reason to doubt that evidence? Or is it pretty specifically the miraculous nature of Jesus?
Well, I guess the thing that first caught my eye was the miraculous pattern of the mythic hero archetype, the heavenly annunciation, miraculous conception, et cetera, miracles, death and resurrection, ascension, and so forth. But as I've gone further into it, suppose we had none of that, we still have problems with the story of Herod the Great and the Bethlehem slaughter, which seems to be based on Josephus's account of the persecution of infant Moses by Pharaoh. We would have problems with the account of Pilate letting go a known insurrectionist, Barabbas, and executing Jesus, whom he himself has declared innocent, a man who was known from Philo and Josephus to be a Jew-hating tyrant. It's just incredible historically. Doesn't involve miracles in any way. It just appears implausible.
Okay, well, let me respond to that, and then by all means, please feel free to respond to my response, because I've heard this a lot about Pilate. It is true that he was Jew-hating. It's also true that at the time when Pilate was ruling as governor in Judea, Emperor Tiberius had, although he had not abdicated the throne, he had all but retired to the island of Capri. And there was an in-between man named Sejanus who was an avid anti-Semite. I don't think they would have used that term in those days, but he hated the Jews, he hated the Israelis, and under him, Pilate was carrying out these policies. Now, there was a complaint, there was a letter and a delegation that had gone forth regarding some of Pilate's policies, particularly when he put up some Roman shields, and Tiberius had instructed him to take them down, and then Sejanus, who tried to overthrow Tiberius, was overthrown and assassinated himself, and Pilate actually, now that he was getting direct communication from Tiberius, was instructed to lay off the Jews. Now, Pilate comes across, certainly, as very wishy-washy in the Gospels, although even in the Gospels, in Luke, of course, they mentioned that he did mingle the blood of the Galileans. So even Luke is saying that he wasn't a nice guy, but he certainly comes across as a wishy-washy politician in the Gospel accounts of the Passion. And I think it's understandable because he's now been told, be nice to the Jews. Well, which Jews? The population of Jews that are following this man Jesus, or the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and elders that make up this puppet court who want Jesus dead? And I could see why he would go back and forth. Finally, they seemed to clinch it when they said, if you don't do as we ask and have this man executed, because only you as a Roman can execute him, we can't except for very special circumstances, you are no friend of Caesar's. This man claims to be a king. You are no friend of Caesar's. Well, those were the magic words. A man who was already not feeling that Caesar was being his friend lately, when he hears the phrase, you are no friend of Caesar's, now he says, okay, I guess the Jews that I'm going to be nice to are the Jewish leaders. And I think that is a very plausible explanation for Pilate's behavior. I'll go ahead and feel free to respond to that.
Well, Pilate was finally dismissed and recalled because he showed no mercy to a Samaritan leader who probably was supposed to be the Taheb, their version of the Messiah, when this man supposedly led a peaceful demonstration on Mount Gerizim, and he was probably going to reveal the location of the temple vessel, supposedly, which is the big messianic act, and Pilate sent undercover men with weapons and just cut them down, though they were unarmed, and the survivors wrote to the Caesar and said, is this Roman justice? And he said, yeah, you're right. And they packed him off to Europe somewhere, and we never hear him again.
Yes, but but they had also complained before that, and he had been told to back off from the way he was treating the Jews by Emperor Tiberius. This account is recorded by the ancient historian Philo. Well, Dr. Price, it's fascinating talking to you. I'm enjoying it as much as last week. So hold on over the break.
Sure.
We will be back. You're listening to the Bob Siegel Show with my very special guest, Dr. Robert Price. Did Jesus exist as a figure in history?
Talk 1170 KCBQ.
Nordingly here, weekend host of Viewpoint San Diego, heard from 1 to 2 p.m. every Saturday on 1210 AM KPRZ, and at that same time on Sunday on News Talk 1170 KCBQ. Write down this number, give them a call, 1-800-4MY-SDBB. That number is to the traveling San Diego Blood Bank. And if they're coming to your area, well, you'll find out by calling that number, and you can help give the gift of life. 1-800-4-MY-SDBB or visit them online at www.sandiegobloodbank.org.
Make the termites go with the name you know. High-tech termite control. The best technology. Microwave, clean, and quick. High-tech.
Hi, everybody. Joe Bauer here. I am doing great. You know why? Because I had high-tech termite control out to my home and got rid of those pesky termites without tent fumigation. Now, high-tech can tent if needed, but why go through the hassle if you don't have to? And they can do homes like mine or large apartment and condo complexes. So call my friend Steve and get 10% off by just mentioning me, Joe Bauer. Call 888-869-9992. That's 888-869-9992.
Make the termites go with the name you know. High-tech termite control. The best technology. Microwave, clean, and quick. High-tech.
Call 888-869-9992.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ, San Diego.
Welcome back. This is Bob Siegel, and my special guest today is Dr. Robert Price. Welcome back to our program, Dr. Price.
Good to be back.
It's great talking to you. Yeah, go ahead.
Regard to the pilot thing, outrageous that pilot inflicted that he was told to cool it on had to do with needless provocations of Jews, like with these standards and shields and stealing money from the temple treasury to pay for the Roman aqueduct and so on. Whereas they certainly would not have minded him crucifying insurrectionary leaders and so forth.
No, they wouldn't have minded him crucifying insurrectionary leaders. You're absolutely right about that. But it is true that the guy that just hated the Jews, Sejanus, is now dead. It would be difficult not to at least consider the possibility that Tiberius is now very suspicious of anyone that's going to continue to carry out Sejanus's policies. And sure, when Pilate was trying Jesus, if he was just an insurrectionist, Tiberius wouldn't mind. But I could see why he'd be wishy-washy on that, because here's this very popular man, and Pilate wasn't able to see exactly what that insurrection was while he was interviewing Jesus. So who do I please? The religious leaders or the religious populace? I could see him being torn by that.
Though, I mean, here we have the Gospels, if they're to be trusted, and I don't think so, but if they are, you've got Pilate bending over backwards and, like, pleading with the crowd not to make him crucify an innocent man.
Of course, because of that, if he can pull that off, if he can come up with the decision that both the Sanhedrin and the Jewish populace like, then he's got his bases covered. He's, again, going back, which set of Jews do I please? He can cover both bases. If the crowd, and then after hearing the crowd, even the leaders say, okay. And then if there's anything that gets back to Tiberius, he says, well, I was considering executing Jesus, but as you know, it was our custom to let somebody go around the time of the Passover.
No evidence for such a custom. Even if there was, can you imagine the Mossad letting Abu Abbas go and executing some school teacher who they themselves knew was innocent? It just seems to me there's the real implausibility of the situation.
Well, here's why I don't think that's implausible. The people that are reporting these things, now, I think you know Dr. Price, or maybe I mentioned it to you last week, maybe you don't. I'm actually a Jewish believer. Now,
yeah.
The only reason I'm going to mention that right now is my concern at the moment is less scholastic and more out of concern for any Jewish person that might be listening. I know the moment anybody talks about the Jews killing Jesus as opposed to the Romans killing Jesus, they sound like some anti-Semite. Well, obviously, I'm not. Both my parents were Jewish. And what's interesting is the people that give us this report, for the most part, are the Jews. The authors of three of the four Gospels, Luke being the exception, are Jews. And in the Talmud, in the section called Sanhedrin 43a, they do mention that a man named Jesus was executed on the Passover on the charge of sorcery and apostasy. Now, the apostasy, supposedly, is because of his claim to deity. Obviously, the Jewish Sanhedrin would not have had a reason to kill somebody who's just a mere rabbi. But a rabbi claiming to be God, claiming not only to be some kind of God, but the one and only true God of Israel, God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. That would be the most horrendous, blasphemous, apostate thing that a Jew could do, unless by chance he was telling the truth and that's who he really was. But certainly the Sanhedrin did not believe that he was God. I don't think you would.
Well, that never comes up in the trial stories, though, and the Sanhedrin tractate of the Talmud is that's anachronistic. They're just spinning off of the Christian version of the story.
Well, that's a suggestion that people have made, but it certainly would not have been to the advantage of the Jews all these years to keep that story in their Talmud. The fact that this has been transmitted and preserved by the Jews and not the Christians seems to challenge the idea that a Christian put it there. I don't mean to say that.
I'm just saying that as a Jewish document, even the Mishnah, now virtually all New Testament scholars follow Jacob Neusner and others and say that this just does not go back that far. None of this material, especially the scant references to Jesus, which seem to be garbled anyway. I believe the same passage has Jesus being hung and stoned to death rather than then hung up to be displayed.
The phrase hung was sometimes used to refer to a crucifixion.
That they stone him to death and then display him according to that passage.
Well, it was common for the writers of the Talmud, even though they were living under the Romans, to write as if they had their own theocracy. So we wouldn't expect them to give credit to the Romans. They were writing as if they were administering God's justice, albeit vicariously.
Jews crucified too, as the Temple Scroll tells us at Qumran.
I'm sorry, what was this about?
The Temple Scroll at Qumran, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, shows that the Jews crucified also.
At what time in history are they claiming that they crucified?
This was right at the time, the first century B.C. to A.D.
But they wouldn't have had the right legally to do that under the Romans. Occasionally, the Romans would give them very special permission to do an execution. Generally, they had to go to the Romans for permission.
Oh, no doubt, but they, well, even that's disputed, but I accept it. But that doesn't mean they couldn't have carried it out their own way. They just need, whether by crucifixion or stoning, they could have done so with Roman permission. They needn't have had Romans
crucified. Right, but you would also admit that even if they had gotten the Roman permission in their own Talmud, that's more of a religious document. They're going to write it as though they were responsible for it. They didn't really want those Romans to be there. Now, you mentioned something else that was interesting, Dr. Price. You said that as we read the gospel accounts, we don't see this blasphemy of him claiming to be God. He actually did when Pilate asked him, "Are you the Son of God?" He said, "I am." Now, when we hear the phrase,
he says, "You say so." "I am" only appears in manuscripts of Mark at the Sanhedrin hearing, and not all manuscripts of Mark. I believe every other gospel version of the trial before the Sanhedrin has "You say that I am" in all versions of Jesus' answer to Pilate. "Have you say I am?"
Well, that still sounds like an affirmation.
I don't think so. It would have been very easy just to say "I am" as some scribes of Mark made it into.
Well, aren't we doing some speculation, though, saying which scribes?
It remains ambiguous. No scholar would say that if you just wanted to say an affirmative, you would hedge it. I mean, it still remains debated among all scholars just what "you say that I am."
I don't know. Here's a Jewish person, Dr. Price, who's being asked if he's the God of Israel.
He's not asked that.
Well, he's being asked if he's
the blessed one,
the Son of God. And that phrase "Son of God," when we use it today, we think, well, we're all children of God. Back then, that did become a title not only for the Messiah, but that became a title for deity at this particular time in Jewish.
Anybody the divine Son of God?
The idea of being the son of the divine meant that you were of like essence with the son.
Not in Judaism. You mentioned
yourself the Dead Sea Scrolls, and there are some references in the Dead Sea Scrolls that talk about that phrase, the Son of God.
Yes, but he's depicted as being the Davidic Scion, but there is nothing about any kind of essentialist speculation or deity at all. There is an odd thing in one midrash in the Dead Sea Scrolls about Melchizedek being the fulfillment of the psalm saying, "Behold your God," but Melchizedek is a whole different character. There's certainly no reference to
it certainly would have been a bizarre concept much earlier in Judaism, but there is evidence that they had that concept at at this time. Also, earlier...
I think not. I beg to differ. In fact, there is older evidence for it when they had the divine king ideology borrowed from the neighboring countries, but the rabbis and the scribes had pretty much pummeled that out of it by this time so that because they wanted to be strict monotheists, and there's no evidence of Judaism at this time having a divine...
Yeah, I'll have to beg to differ with you, and I'd be happy to send you some of these quotations that I've found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That was also a very common phrase in the Grecian-Roman world, which is something that you like to point out, but we will point these things out when we get back from our break. Thank you, Dr. Price. You are listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ.
It was a windy March day. The switchboard was lit up like a Christmas tree. Who would have guessed that telephone receptionist Emma Lyman would fire her boss? Hi, how in the world are you anyway? This is Andy Willoughby with the 3-Step Plan Home Business System. Emma started a home business and in less than a year was making 4 times more money than she had made working at a job she hated. To find out how you could make more money working from home, go to 3stepplan.com or call 800-305-5482. 800-305-5482.
Meeting teen girls online is easy. It's as simple as going into a chat room and starting up conversations. Chatting seems safe to them, so they're much easier to approach than they would be in person. Once we start chatting, I act as cool and understanding as possible. I wait out their suspicions. The longer we talk, the more they trust me. Usually it doesn't take all that long. When they send me their picture, I tell them how hot they are. A lot of girls have never had a guy tell them they're beautiful or special or smart, so they eat it up. After I have them convinced we're soulmates and I should be their boyfriend and all that, I ask them to meet in person. The trick is never saying we have to meet. You ask them, make it seem like it's their choice. Once I get them to meet me, well, that's when things get really interesting.
Online predators know what they're doing. Do you?
1 in 5 kids online is sexually solicited. Don't believe the type. Visit cybertipline.com to learn how you can protect yourself from online predators. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Dr. Katie Rodan. Dr. Kathy Fields and I created Proactive Solution because acne is the number one problem we see in our practices. As dermatologists, we treat acne as a physical condition. But what really affected us was seeing the emotional toll acne takes. So maybe you're the one with the breakouts. You shy away from social situations. You avoid being photographed, or you won't leave the house without makeup. So what's preventing you from trying Proactiv? My guess is that you're afraid. You're afraid that it just won't work. Afraid to get your hopes up, only to be disappointed. This time you don't have to worry. We are so confident that Proactiv will work for you that I'm offering you a 60-day risk-free trial of Proactiv Solution.
To get your risk-free 60-day trial of Proactiv Solution, just call 1-800-420-8744 and you'll become a believer. Call 1-800-420-8744. 1-800-420-8744. Call now.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ, San Diego.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. I'm here with my very special guest, Dr. Robert Price. The discussion, did Jesus exist as a historical figure? Welcome back to our program, Dr. Price.
Good to be back. Just to follow up this thing about what Son of God meant and how I like to, at other points, bring in the pagan parallels and so on, it's certainly true that there were holy men whom Greek and Roman people thought were literally the sons of God, apparently in an essentialist sense, demigods, like Pythagoras was supposed to be the son of Apollo, Apollonius of Tyana was supposed to be the son of Proteus and all that. That would raise Nicene-type questions about their lineage, but I'm assuming, for the sake of argument, that the trial scene would have made sense to Jewish priests in a historical setting, in which case they certainly would not have had such things in mind. But it seems to me that really we have no idea what would have happened at such a trial, even if there was one. And I think that, as with much of the Passion narrative, even this scene is a rewrite of something in the Old Testament.
Well, Hellenism had quite an influence on Judaism, and even more so with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. But again, there is a reference to the Son of God in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. The corroboration that I see here, though, is that we have on one hand a Jewish document, the Talmud. Granted, it was transmitted orally originally, but it's mentioning that he was executed on some kind of heresy. And you said yourself, if he was just a good teacher, then obviously what would that heresy have been? Somebody claiming to be the Messiah would not have automatically been viewed as heresy.
Right.
He would have had to do the credentials, but the credentials in those days, in that mindset, because of the anticipation raised by the brief independence brought about by Judas Maccabeus, the whole Hanukkah story, was that Jesus would go in there and beat the snot out of the Romans. I do find it interesting. You mentioned Jacob Nausner as one of the very trusted translators, and of course this is the version I've found in every library I've gone to look at. Back in the days when I went to libraries and didn't just cruise the internet and do it more quickly, I found something very fascinating in the writings of Jacob Nausner. When he got to that section, Sanhedrin 43a in the Babylonian Talmud, the passage in question, he made a very interesting note. Most translations of the Talmud omit this text, and I'm going, why would they do that? But I appreciated his integrity. I just think that verifies that this is a text with all the anti-Semitism and all the arguments over who killed Jesus, the Jews or the Romans. Obviously, I believe it was a collaborated effort according to the Gospels. But boy, that's if some people are not even including it, but they still have the integrity to admit that it's there. They do admit that they're skipping verses.
Oh, yeah, I just think it's would never do that. But he's right. That's why there may have been other stuff about Jesus that isn't in there, because it was omitted from all copies because Jews feared Christian reprisal.
Right, but that just makes it all the more fascinating that something like this survived. Certainly that's not something that the Jews are going to be happy to have there, and for that to have survived, that means that there's somebody with incredible integrity. Let me just
it's
go back.
It's too late to count as evidence.
Why is
if it had been written in 80 A.D., that would be too late. It would be after the destruction of the temple when there were no witnesses around.
Well, anything in history, for it to be called history, happens after the effect. That's the case with anything in ancient history. Isn't that correct? Alexander the Great did a lot of his exploits around the years 323 BC to and the earliest really good exhaustive record of things that he did was written some 400 years later.
And he's already the Son of God who bound Gog and Magog beneath the mountain.
Okay. Well, that's your change of the subject. I doubt that you don't believe that Alexander the Great existed, whatever you think about his beliefs.
Yes,
just because a historian wrote
overwhelming contextual evidence tying him into the flow of history.
Okay,
whereas with Jesus, the two places at his birth and death, both of the stories are rife with implausibility.
Well, now what was implausible? I know I responded to the Pontius Pilate part. I did want to respond to the Herod.
No,
you don't agree with the way I'm responding, and that's fair.
You cannot explain letting Barabbas go, who is a known killer of Romans in some insurrection, and saying, well, this Jesus guy, he's harmless, but okay, let's let the killer of Romans go and kill this guy.
Well, that's based on your belief that custom to release a prisoner at the Passover.
There's no evidence for it.
Well, I think other people would say that
there is plenty of evidence for a mock king custom, the Saturnalia, various Babylonian and other precedents. It seems like we have yet another piece of pagan lore sneaking into the Gospels this way.
Well, let's put a hold on the pagan lore sneaking in. I know that's important, you know, but let me first respond to what you said about Herod. It's true that Josephus doesn't record anything about Herod. Now, the Roman writers, we don't expect that they would necessarily care that much about what happened in a very small town in Israel. But certainly, it's consistent with Herod's character. The guy was just a lunatic. He was evil. He killed almost everybody in his family. He loved his pets more. There was an anonymous quote that said, "I'd rather be one of Herod's pigs than a member of his family." So it's certainly no big jump to imagine that he certainly could have done something like that. And we don't know how many in a small town. It might have just been a small enough number that it really didn't gather the attention. Josephus takes what I think is a very interesting, but obviously a very casual interest in Jesus. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Price. Isn't it true that, for want of a better term, I think your opinion of scholars and my opinion of scholars is probably the same, that somebody being a scholar is not the issue. The issue is, what are they saying? Why are they saying it? What is their evidence? I read something to that effect. And I appreciated that, by the way, when you said just because the majority of scholars say this or that, it doesn't mean anything, which is probably why you ended up dissenting from the Jesus seminar, which the other decisions they made that I would have disagreed with, one thing they did do is come to the conclusion that Jesus did in fact live. You dissented from that. But anyway, isn't it true that those scholars who conclude that Jesus never did miracles are assuming a naturalistic view of the universe? And tell the truth, isn't beginning that way, beginning with the kind of closed mind that Christians are frequently accused of having?
It would be, but I believe that is a gross misnomer and a false charge. Not that you're knowingly making it, but you've inherited it. The thing is that, for instance, Bultmann, supposedly the arch skeptic, never denied that Jesus did what he and his contemporaries would have considered miracles. He thought that, there were healings, there were exorcisms, that the reason we have no problem accepting this in principle is that you can still see these things done today. I mean, what you think is happening is a different matter. Is it supernaturalism? Is it abnormal psychology? Is it psychosomatics?
Right, but see, coming up with those kinds of explanations is similar to what I'm saying.
No, I mean is, Bultmann said that's a different issue entirely. The thing is, if you go to a certain places, you can see people casting out demons, as Jesus is shown doing. There's no reason to think you wouldn't have seen him do it either. So it doesn't get into the question of whether it could or couldn't happen. I'm just saying that even if someone were inclined to explain it rationalistically, they wouldn't deny that had happened, because there are ample historical analogies.
Right, but I guess when I was using the term miracle, I wasn't talking about the fact that certainly people could see a phenomenon like a demon being cast out or a healing and try to come up with some explanation, but when Bultmann or whoever is done with that explanation, it's not going to be a miracle as we conventionally understand.
Well, they don't get into that. That's really a different issue. Rudolf Otto figured that holy men often have an ability to read your mind. And he says Jesus is shown doing that. We've seen people do that. However you explain it, you needn't deny it. But do we ever see any Pentecostal faith healers walking on water or changing water into wine or ascending into heaven? It's not that we think these things cannot happen, but since we weren't there and don't have a time machine, all we can do is to compare claims and stories with the analogies we have on hand, the analogy of observed experience, and there happen to be no analogies of these, or the analogy of ancient legends, which there are many of.
Okay, but when you use the phrase analogy,
where they fit.
When you use the phrase analogy of experience, I think you're just saying in a different way what I was saying.
No, sir, not at all.
Okay, well, I'll give you a chance to explain what you meant to say when we come back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show with Dr. Robert Price.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ.
Hi, this is Dick Drury with Kitchen and Bath Experts, your experts at designing and building your dream kitchen. Kitchen and Bath Experts is a full-service general contractor. We build your dream kitchen from design through all aspects of construction with quality you and your family will love.
You've heard Dick Drury's Kitchen and Bath Expert Show Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. on KCBQ and KPRZ. Now attend his free kitchen design seminar on Saturday morning, October 8th from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Check out their beautiful new 4,000-square-foot showroom at 7475 Claremont South Mesa Boulevard. Attend the Saturday Morning Kitchen Design Seminar and receive $500 off the design fee for your new kitchen. Learn about the important details of kitchen design, cabinet construction, plumbing, flooring, and more. Seating is limited for this free kitchen design seminar Saturday morning, October 8th. Call 858-874-5800 now to reserve your space and receive your $500 discount. That's 858-874-5800.
California Contractors License Number 350907.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ, San Diego.
Welcome back to our program. I'm here with my very special guest and a very nice guy and always stimulating, Dr. Robert Price. Welcome back, Dr. Price.
Good to be back.
Now, I know that, see, I said assuming a naturalistic view of the universe. You said, well, no, they're not assuming that, but there has to be an analogy. And that in the analogy, you gave the example that since we don't see people turning water into wine or walking on water, then aren't you in fact saying that when we see those things, we're going to doubt them? I can understand.
No, not at all. The thing is, if we were to see it, like for instance, people used to say, well, the yogis claimed that they could govern their body temperature and stop their heart. Ho ho, what a lot of malarkey. And then it turns out, hey, these guys can do it. Whether you understand it or not, you now have to be chastened and say, well, what do you know? The reality is bigger than we thought.
Sure. And this, and we're talking about a historical record, and we don't have a time machine, but we don't have a time machine to go back and see anything in history.
Yes, but that implies agnosticism, not fideism. The thing is, anything could have happened, but just because, like, suppose you say you are a believer in miracles, and you look at B.B. Warfield's book, Counterfeit Miracles, where he goes through all kinds of medieval things with the miracles of the Eucharistic host and visions of the Virgin Mary. Just because you believe miracles are possible doesn't mean that legends are impossible. And how do you know when this miracle story or that one is false?
Right. That's a good question. That's a good question. And then another question on the other hand, though, would be, doesn't science do things today that would have been viewed as miraculous by somebody 2,000 years ago?
Yes, but that's not of much help because that leads you into the Jesus was a space alien theory.
No, not necessarily. I would say it leads to the theory that, because again, and this piggybacks on what we were talking about last week, it depends on whether somebody's assuming or not assuming a God. If somebody opens this up and says there may or may not be a God, and if this God exists, he may or may not be able to do some things which have a scientific explanation, but I just don't have it yet myself. Dr. Price, when we look at how much technology changed in just the last 100 years, the 20th century, and then adding on the few more years of the 21st century, we have done things that obviously would have looked miraculous. See, now when I use the word miracle, and I can't answer for every Christian who's talked to you, when I use the word miracle, my definition of it is that God is doing something that actually does have a scientific explanation. We just don't yet know what the scientific explanation is. Therefore, the $50 million question would be, once again, if the same amount of testimonies, eyewitnesses, and historians which talk about the life of Jesus and its miraculous nature merely talk about a Jesus starting a revolution or giving a speech, I question who would doubt it. Although, as you said, we could doubt anything in history. Aren't the miracles causing people to enter it with more doubt from the beginning?
I don't believe so. For one thing, no historians speak of Jesus doing miracles, even if you take everything in Tacitus and the more modest version, the less interpolated version of Josephus. None of them say that.
Well, let's take a look at
historians were credulous about miracles.
Let's take a look at Josephus, and as you said, and I'll say this from the onset, I'm very aware that people think this was a Christian interpolation. I have a whole article about that on my website, but just for the sake of our listeners, let me read this to you. This was written by Josephus in Antiquities, Book 18. Josephus did live after Christ, probably was born around the time Christ died, but he was a contemporary of the apostles, certainly had access to people who would have known Jesus. And here's what Josephus says. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. Now, since Josephus is writing as a historian, and since we know Josephus was not a Christian,
whoever wrote that was,
well,
he was the Messiah. He fulfilled thousands of prophecies by rising from the dead. It's as if Josephus said Muhammad is the seal of the prophets. Would we have any trouble recognizing that as an interpolation?
Well, I find this very interesting because virtually no historian has any problem believing that Tacitus, when he wrote that a person called Christ was executed under Pontius Pilate,
because
really
he doesn't
believed
say he's the Messiah. All he says is some people do doubt that. I don't, but that Tacitus wrote it. But all he says is that Christianity was founded by one Christus, who was put to death under the procuratorship of Pontius Pilate.
Yes, and since Christus was the Greek, and in the case of Tacitus, a more Latinized version of Messiah, obviously you read that and I read that. We agree that Tacitus probably really did say that. We don't think that because Tacitus used the word Christ that he must have believed that Josephus was the Messiah. Now,
Josephus says, accordingly, he was the Christ about whom many such things were predicted. This is a Christian statement, and Origen, who wrote hundreds of years before our copies of Josephus, said he had read Josephus, and one thing was for sure, he did not believe Jesus to be the Messiah.
That's right.
He's not reading what we're reading.
Actually, Josephus believed that Emperor Vespasian was the Messiah, but see, I think that strengthens the case, because here's what people do. They say, show me somebody who claims Jesus rose from the dead other than a Christian. And
well,
I go, okay.
But don't you see, he wouldn't have been in a position to know anyway. He's just reporting what was being said.
Right, but what I'm saying is he could have not believed in Christianity himself, but if he finds the evidence when he talks to different eyewitnesses so overwhelming.
He almost certainly couldn't have.
What do you mean he couldn't have? He was a contemporary of the apostles.
If he's writing, doing a history of Jews outside of Palestine 20 years after the fall of Jerusalem, who's left to talk to that would ever have seen Jesus?
The Apostle Paul, the Apostle
Peter. Who
died
30 years before?
The Apostle Paul was executed in 64 A.D. but under Emperor Nero.
That's 30 years before Josephus is writing.
Well, are you talking about when Josephus' writing was published and put about? Or are you talking about when Josephus
either way,
first went
it's
out?
Much too late. He's writing decades after Paul's gone.
Wait a minute. First of all, when he wrote it and when he gathered the information are not the same thing. Second of all, we accept things in ancient history all the time that were written much later.
No, historian just accepts it because somebody said it.
You told
There's
me a moment ago that you accept the writing.
What is in Josephus, and it has nothing to do with miracles.
But you accept the writings of Alexander the Great.
No, I don't. No, they're already laden with legend and propaganda.
No, my question was, did Alexander the Great exist? Did Alexander the Great conquer the known world? And you said yes, and it's very steep with history. I know you said
that's
that.
That's right. Yes, there's all kinds of adjacent information.
Well, I think there's all kinds of adjacent information with Jesus.
Not.
Well, now let's get back to Jesus calling him the Christ. Once again, Josephus calling him the Christ. Josephus mentions many Jesuses. I have a copy of the Complete Works of Josephus. It was a very common name. Isn't it possible that by calling him Christ, he's merely telling people which Jesus he's referring to?
That's not what he's saying in context. He's making a clear point that, accordingly, he was the Christ about whom these and myriad other things were prophesied.
No, but what I have in front of me, the William Whiston translation, he was the Christ, period. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had him condemned to the cross, then he goes on and talks about how he appeared that those who loved him, when he calls them a tribe of Christians, he's obviously distinguishing himself from the Christians. The truth is, although some people believe there are interpolations, most scholars accept most of this, some scholars accept all of this, but all of us will be back from this break. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ.
The Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation exists to provide financial support for children of Marines for their higher education. Special consideration is given to the children whose Marine parents have been killed or disabled, fighting for you and this country in the wars against terrorism. Help support us by contributing to these enduring values of education. Call 1-866-IWO-JIMA for more information. That's 1-866-IWO-JIMA for more information.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ, San Diego.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. I'm joined with my very special guest and very likable guy, Dr. Robert Price. Dr. Price, we're down to our last segment, and because the time goes by quickly and we'll probably be in the middle of something when it's time to go, I want to, at this time, before we continue talking, thank you so much for taking the time to be on our program. I do respect you as a person that sincerely looks for truth, even though we haven't had a whole lot of conclusions to agree with, about, except for Star Trek. It looks like we agreed that Tacitus probably really wrote that, which that was good. But thank you so much for coming on the
program. Thanks for having me. It's such a delight.
It is. And I do hope we can schedule you again sometime and maybe in a reoccurring way. Come on. I know that in 1 hour you're not going to ever feel you had a chance to say everything you had to say. And we don't want to censor you. We want you to feel free to come back often and get all your points out there.
That'd be great. I'd much appreciate it.
Okay. Now, we were talking about Josephus, and I had mentioned that he may just be referring to which Jesus he was talking about. Another one of the reasons people believe it's an interpolation, even though this exists in every extant manuscript of Antiquities 18, and therefore I believe the burden of proof is on those who say it's an interpolation to prove that in this case, is that the idea that if Josephus wasn't a Christian, then why would he have said that Christ rose from the dead? Well, Josephus was a Pharisee at one time in his life. He had later on gone on to become a general. But obviously, Jews could have believed in bodies popping out of the ground in those days, whether someone today believes that or not, without necessarily coming to the conclusion that the person was God, and without necessarily coming to the conclusion that the person was the Messiah. Since we have another text that is usually undisputed, where he talks about the death of James, the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ.
That's another interpolation,
well,
I think.
Well, but the fact that he's calling him this, a Christian that's going to do an interpolation, why would he go and write the word so-called?
Well, he doesn't, actually. It is a case of what you just mentioned as a possibility with the other one to differentiate what Jesus he means. It just means Jesus called the Christ, as opposed to Jesus ben Saphius and these other guys like you mentioned.
Sure, and since he went out of his way to say it at one time, isn't it possible that he assumed people knew what he meant the other time?
And that led up to the other reference makes it clear he's saying he was the Messiah. It's the sentence and the point are altogether different. The problem with this one is that in it, Josephus seems to say that it was the taking away of the bulwark, James the Just, that led, in some people's minds, to the destruction of Jerusalem. But Origen said that Josephus said that it was the killing of... Origen read this and said that Josephus attributed the fall of Jerusalem to the stoning of James the Just, which he does not, whereas in our passage about John the Baptist in Josephus, he says Jews attributed the fall of Jerusalem, or the defeat of Herod at the hands of Aretas the IV, to his beheading John. The thing is, again, Origen was reading a different version of Josephus than we have, and that more than meets the burden of proof, especially with this thing where he said Josephus didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah. Plus, there are other textual sources like the 10th century Arabic version that Shlomo Pines discovered, where it has a shorter version that does not say he rose from the dead or that he was the Messiah.
Well, but in that version, in the Shlomo Pines version, and I'm glad you brought that up, it does say things like reportedly he was said to have risen from the dead. Frankly, if it were ever proven that that was the original version, because we're dealing with extant manuscripts for everything in the ancient world, not just
Josephus. By the way, only Christians preserved Josephus. Jews hated him as a traitor, so it's no surprise that all current Christian copies...
And yet we have the scholar from Hebrew University, Joseph Klausner, who does accept not all, but the majority of that passage, so obviously he's not letting any kind of Christian bias enter in because he doesn't have any Christian bias. But again, doesn't that make sense that if Josephus was somebody who believed in resurrections, that he could believe in a resurrected Jesus without obligated to call
him? I hate to be so contrary, but when he describes the beliefs of the Pharisees, he had Hellenized them to such a degree that he has them as Stoics believing in reincarnation. He says the Pharisees believe people would enter into another body, and he seems to have radically Hellenized their teaching, so we don't know that he would have thought a body could come out of the tomb back to life again.
Well, he also recorded a paraphrase of the Old Testament, and the Old Testament had people like Daniel and people like Elijah talking about, in one case, and being involved with something very much like a resurrection in another case. By calling those scriptures true, he's certainly saying that he agrees.
Yes, but to say that God raised from the dead the Shunammite woman's child, and saying he raised from the dead Frank down the street in a Pentecostal church. I mean, one might believe the first because the Bible said it, and the second, well, who knows? God could do it, but did he? Is there any real reason to think so?
Well, Dr. Price, even if he had a more Hellenized view of the resurrection, there's so little. See, I think the lack of detail in this passage is what's so telling. For one thing, if a Christian had put this in here, and just put it in, why wouldn't they have written a lot more?
Well, because they knew they couldn't go too far, though they did. They apparently realized they had to put on some brakes, but if they had kept it to what Josephus really could have said, then there would have been no point in interpolating.
But you will admit that that's an opinion, and that every extant manuscript has it. Dr. Price,
They didn't always. Vossius in the 18th century, I think, claimed he had a copy of Josephus that did not contain it at all.
He may have claimed that, but he doesn't have that copy to show us, and it's not in a museum. We've got to go. Thank you, my friend. Let's talk again sometime.
Great.
And I hope
right.
I can meet you in person and have a cup of coffee
Terrific.
With you sometime. You've been fantastic.
You too. Thank
okay.
You.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We will have another hour of the Bob Siegel Show on KPRZ 1210 on your dial, not too far from where you are now. I'll see you on the other side of the dial.